Hey guys, welcome back to Midnight in the Mountains. On this episode, I have Morgan Knudsen again, and she is here to talk about her re-release of her book, Teaching the Living. We also get into some Wendigo lore and some creepy dogman stories. Before we get started, if you have an encounter you would like to share with me, please email me at midnight_inthemountains@yahoo.com. You can also find me on Instagram at midnight_inthemountains. Also, please rate and review the show on your podcatcher. All right, thanks, guys. Let's get into it. Morgan, it's good to have you back again. And since I've last talked to you, you have a new book out now.
Yeah, it's good to be back. The last show was so much fun. I have a brand new book. We just launched it called Teaching the Living, From Heartbreak to Happiness in a Haunted Home. And it's the second edition of my original book, which I'm really excited about because it's got about 100 brand new pages of up-to-date information in the field of parapsychology. And we go into some pretty amazing stuff like Dogman and whatnot. But mainly the idea behind the book was that I wanted to impart the program that I've been teaching here in Canada for about 20 years to everybody. I want everybody to have this information. And it was very popular in the post-secondary psychology and social work programs here. And it's been invaluable for clients just all over the world that I had when I was, still doing investigations consistently. And it's meant as a handbook, but now it's also, it's more than that because we've got this added brand new, mind-blowing, in my opinion, information about where parapsychology is now.
What are some of the new things that you have added to it?
There's been so much. Like, I'm just super excited about this thing. So
I can hear it. You sound so excited. That's cool.
Yeah, like there was information recently that was compiled in the Advancements in Parapsychology textbook, 10th edition, that came out just this past year. Information and papers from a fellow by the name of Dr. William Roll, who really pulled in quantum physics to parapsychology and the paranormal. And so his work gets summarized in here, how it applies to our everyday life now, how it's applicable, how we create our reality in terms of the paranormal, how we are responsible for some of the things that happen, advancements in psychokinesis, and there's just so much. And those are probably my favorite pieces in there. What's great about this and the understanding that they're coming to is the fact that not only is it about the physical brain, but it's also about consciousness being translated by the brain. So it becomes so much bigger than what we can get our little minds around. It's bigger than that, and really parapsychology for me, and I think for many other researchers out there, it really has become a journey into understanding humanity. And that's what I'm really trying to encapsulate with the book, is that there is no separation from us and, what we are experiencing. We are creating those experiences as we move through the world, and just by a token of our focus. And when we understand that, then the paranormal phenomenon becomes not only far more fascinating, in my opinion, but, it puts the power back into people's hands who are afraid of it.
Yeah, it adds so many levels to it.
It's like an onion, it's just...
Right.
You can just keep peeling it. And the more we delve into the science of it and the idea that, consciousness is fundamental and not necessarily emergent, which means it's coming through the brain, the more we understand that there is more than, the implications of that are just huge.
And it's really comforting also, because, life after death, and a lot of people fear that. And you realize that your consciousness will still be here no matter what.
Yeah, like our survivalist philosophies and the idea that these events and life after death is something that is pervasive within our world. It is. There's a comfort. There's hope. There is the knowledge that if we pass on, those connections can still exist for us with the people that we love. And I think that is so crucial in even just moving people through the grief process.
Oh, it's huge. I know it's done wonders for me since I kind of walked into the paranormal world 3 years ago now.
Yeah, it's so important. And, you know, when we miss out on those connections, then we kind of miss out on, I think, on a broader part of who we are. You know, we're sort of cutting that part of ourselves off. And that's not a good thing either, because I'm of the opinion we're really born with these connections and this information. I think, you know, little kids, you know, as long as they're not told that that you know, this stuff doesn't exist, then they see it, they pursue it. They, you know, they're not blind to a relative coming to visit and things like that. Where as we grow older, we put in these filters and these belief systems, and we start to cut ourselves off from the larger part of who we are. And we just get to be, you know, miserable. People get miserable, and it's just, yeah, there's so much more out there that can be tapped into and can make our lives 100% better. But, you know, we can, the great thing about, I think, this information and the way it translates, and what I love so much about the paranormal and how it ties in to humanity and the connection we have with others, is even watching it branch into things like folklore, things like legend, things that we sort of consider ghosts and goblins that we've, you know, always kind of considered fairy tales. And what I found really interesting throughout my 20 years of doing this is that legends are so often getting something right. I had a really great interview on my podcast, Supernatural Circumstances, with Dr. Lynn McNeil from the University of Utah. She's a folklore professor. And what was so interesting to me was that she had said, folklore, it can be true or it can be false, but it's always right. We had this very interesting conversation about these different ideas like ghosts and creatures and all sorts of things. And what was cool for me about that was, you know, we really got into the topic of how our thoughts and our focus manifest into things that have a thinking mind, thinking brain in a way, or a thinking consciousness. It was very, very fascinating. So that's all in the book as well, is this idea that our consciousness, when we focus enough, that those thoughts become the thinker. And it's fascinating study.
Yeah. And to go into some of the folklore, and you had written about the Wendigo in a chapter, and also, you have two episodes on your podcast, Supernatural Circumstances, on that also, which I highly recommend. Do you want to go into the Wendigo a little bit from there?
Yeah, the Wendigo is interesting because it was funny. Well, recently I was asked to write a foreword for an upcoming book, and my friend and I were talking about the idea of winter folklore and things like that. And what I found really interesting when I went to sit down to write about the foreword, because the Wendigo was really in the forefront of my mind when I sat down to write the foreword, simply because it's a very large part of Alberta folklore here in Canada. It's a big deal. And one of the things that I had thought about as I was writing it and thinking back to the stuff that I'd written in Teaching the Living was that monsters don't live in the dark. They live in the cold, and the darkness simply follows. And I started this forward with that because the Wendigo is a really specific element, and almost caricature, even though it seems to be an entity with a consciousness, of winter and isolation and silence. And what's interesting about the Wendigo is that oftentimes in the lore, when you dig into it, it's preceded by an owl, and people say that if you see the owl, the Wendigo is not far behind, or the Wendigo has become the owl itself. And I found this so fascinating because the winter here, and when you really get into it, because we just got out of like a minus 45 dip in temperature, and it was ridiculous. But the thing with the winter in the wilds of Alberta and the Great Lakes and things like that is that there is a silence that is so pervasive. And what is so interesting to me about the lore of the Wendigo and the owl is that you have this silent predator, and the winter here is very much like a silent predator. It just comes in on the wind, and you never hear it, you never see it, and you look at it and it's very beautiful. It's got ice crystals in the air, you know, everybody thinks of it like a Christmas card. It's got this beautiful stillness, but you know, if you're outside in that for more than a few minutes, you know, that's going to kill you. Like, that, it's dangerous. And with the Wendigo is so representative of that, because you walk into something like that, you walk into a situation with a creature like that that's embodied, that silent killer, and it's a predator and a folklore tale unlike, I think, any other in the world.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the owl portion of it because I was re-listening to that, the part one of the Wendigo lore episode, and I had noted that you guys were talking about the owl, which I had never heard in Wendigo. I'd only heard about it when it comes to aliens. So I thought that was pretty interesting because then it just shows that there's other cultures that feature the owl with something supernatural, like down in, I think, Mexico or South America, they have the Chusa, turns into owl, which is a witch. And then now here it's seen as the Wendigo. And then also in America, we associate it with aliens. I think that's pretty interesting.
It is. It's an interesting crossover. And I think again it comes down to that symbolism and how they move and what it represents. Like, when you think of the owl, and especially out here, when you're in the wilds and the snow, all you can hear is yourself. Like, you can be walking through woods and you just hear your boots under the snow. It's super loud. Everything is so dead quiet because the snow absorbs sound that every move that you're making is, it's almost impossible to be quiet. And here's this humongous bird, this beautiful animal that can maneuver its way through this environment in complete silence. And the Wendigo is kind of the same way, which is one of the things I think that makes it so terrifying, because it shifts and moves through its environment in a way where you don't see it coming. There's a trust level in the environment that the Wendigo and the owl, for that matter, breaks down because you can't see it coming. It is, you stop being able to trust your senses because you're not going to hear this predator approaching. And I think there's something to that in the innate nature of these creatures that frighten the heck out of us because we are so used to engaging our senses and being able to predict or see trouble coming. And both of these things, you can't see it coming. You have no control over it. It's on you before you have any say in the matter.
And that's so unsettling. It's,
Isn't it?
yeah, the Wendigo is one of the more fascinating lores, and that's why I wanted to especially talk about that with you because it is probably, one of my favorites other than Dogman, because it's just there's just something about it. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, and it's not just you. I mean, I think in the last number of years, it's really encapsulated the minds of a lot of people because it is so representative and invokes just the right level of instinctual fear that we try to avoid as living beings. It's got this ability to, as I say, break down, trust in our environment, but also trust in ourselves. Because, if you are possessed by the Wendigo, it said that it will take you over and you will lose your faculties. It pushes us to a grim reality that we might, eat another human being, and then at the same time, you've got this thought form, this idea that is being built upon by cultures. As the legend grows and moves along, you've got all of these cultures, whether it be the Europeans coming in, different influences with different First Nations groups, so on and so forth. You've got all of these influences that are building that energy and creating something new. So it's morphing constantly. That's a scary thing when you think about it.
Yeah, I wonder if the morphing, and I think this is kind of what you were getting at, is that our thoughts are changing it. Is that what you were kind of?
Yeah, I think there's some validity to that. We in Canada, there was an experiment done back in the 1970s by the Society of Psychical Research here in and this was in Toronto, but here in Canada, and Mensa as well was a part of it. And it was known as the Philip Experiment. And the Philip Experiment, which I talk about in the book as well, is so definitive and so important to understand when it comes to things like the Wendigo and other apparitions, parapsychology, and things like that. Because what happened was that they sat down and created through focus an energy that was responsive to questions. They didn't do it in the sense that they didn't sit down and think, okay, we're going to contact so-and-so. They created a character named Philip, and it had a backstory, and it had all of these different factors going on. And they succeeded in making this thing real enough that it was responding to jokes. It was moving furniture. It had a physical presence in the space. And then they repeated the experiment again with another group, with a character by the name of Lilith that they created. And again, they were able to replicate this. And it was completely through their own focused thought and attention that this intelligence, this being, seemed to come into existence. So it was not only an incredible experiment in psychokinesis, but it also goes to show that our focus and, you know, what we dwell on, what we believe in, we can manifest. And so when you've got, you know, hundreds of years of focus into a belief that this is, you know, a living, breathing entity, or at least a non-physical entity, then everybody says, well, you know, it's folklore, it's not real. Well, hold on a minute. Does it matter? Is if you're speaking it and you're speaking this into existence, does it matter whether it was a tale? Because, you know, this thing can, you know, these might be able to manifest. And I think that's the key with things like the Wendigo, and why there's such a buildup of attention around it.
Yeah, that's a good point. That just unsettles me. I don't like that. I just don't like that idea. As interesting as it is, I don't know.
It's next level scary.
It is. And it's hard to, like you said earlier, it's hard to wrap your head around it.
Yeah, well, it's so in depth. And, you know, with what we're beginning to understand, you know, I think that the takeaway from things like this is that our focus matters. What we're paying attention to, the energy that we're putting out, how we are going into the world, and the stories that we are telling ourselves matter. Because, you know, just as well as we can, you know, if we can manifest something that is terrifying, we can also manifest something that is incredibly positive and beautiful. So I think it works both ways. But I think this information and where parapsychology is going right now, and our understanding of what our minds and our imaginations are capable of doing, is really going to be key for us as humans, just, you know, moving into the world. And individually, we can make that choice as well, which is, I think, is really important. And it opens up a lot of doors.
Yeah, to simplify it, because I feel like it's so easy just to fall into a negative. I feel like it's so much harder to remind yourself to jump into higher, you know, positivity. And with this, if this research comes out and people realize this, not everybody, but maybe some people will see this and just remember to be more positive, that you can manifest good energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is a decision. You know, it really is. And, you know, whether people, you know, dive into this research or not, I think the stories that we tell ourselves, they have to reflect what it is that we want from the world. And if we are thrown around by our circumstances, if we are dictated emotionally by the things that are going on around us, then we've got the tail wagging the dog. And as soon as you have the tail wagging the dog, then you've lost power in your life experience. You've gone off the rails. I think this idea is to be able to sit down and go, okay, if this is going on, how do I choose now to move into this arena? And how do I choose to talk to myself about what is going on, and to become a disciplinarian about that? You know, like, care how you feel, care about the level of joy that you have.
And that's it right there. Exactly what you just said.
Yeah. It's really about caring about how you feel enough that you are worth it to do better in how you're telling your own story, how you're telling the story about other people, you know, about the craziness that's going on in the world right now, even stuff like that. You know, you don't have to like it, but if you can make peace with where you are and then tell a new story, it is incredible how things in your environment actually begin to shift and change. The universe will accommodate every time.
Yeah, I've seen so many instances. You start to pay attention to things more, and things fall right into place.
They do, and people tend to sort of brush it under the rug and think, oh, it's coincidence, yeah, it's coincidence. But it's not coincidence. And,
no,
you know, we realize that every event, every, whether it be paranormal or not, has a frequency, and we really do get where we are emotionally, you know. And people think, well, you get what you think about. No, you get what you're feeling about. And if you're sitting in fear and isolation and terror and trauma, and you're sitting in that energy, then is it any wonder that you're in the receiving place of something like the Wendigo? You know, here you've got something that is a manifestation of that. And so now all of a sudden you're within range of those experiences. And just in the same way, you could be at the other end of the spectrum where you're deliberately choosing joy and you've got things going on or whatever, and you get more of that.
I want to jump a little to the side. Have there been any recent sightings of Wendigo within, say the last 50 years, even 100 years from where you're from?
There has, and it's not common. So there's been quite a number of accounts that have happened and been documented over the years. They're not super common. Sightings of what people believe of the Wendigo tend to be very fleeting. I document a possibility of one in my book, Teaching the Living, where a friend of mine had a childhood experience that is very, very hard to discount. And, you know, he's been met with somewhat of a fair bit of criticism, people thinking that, well, it's sleep paralysis, or, you know, you were a young kid having a nightmare and things like that. But the events around what happened with him and the proximity to a very, very famous case of the Wendigo, which was the Swift Runner case in Alberta in the about 1896, the proximity and everything that went down in that area was troubling. And I think he's definitely of the assumption and the belief that this was indeed either the Wendigo itself, or he was picking up on the imagery and the thought forms of things that had happened back then. So there's encounters and things like that are out there. There was another one near Spooner, Wisconsin, that Chad Lewis investigated, where it was two young boys who believed they saw one at a campground. And that was just a few years ago. So I think the encounters are out there, but they're not super common, because again, you've got something that is moving by stealth, and it's silent, and it moves in a very, very specific way. And oftentimes during the winter, when you're not out and about.
Yeah, that's a good point too. And how many people, maybe there's other people that have had these experiences, but some people aren't going to tell anybody about it because they don't want to be seen as crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a stigma specifically with creatures like the Wendigo, because it is deemed as something that is a story. It has to be mm-hmm. a story. And because it's a story, there can't be truth in it. And it's a weird place of thinking when it comes with people. But oftentimes people believe that these stories, these experiences are based from stories, when oftentimes our stories are based from experiences. And people don't realize that. They automatically think, well, you've had the experience because you believed in this story and so on and so forth. And that's often not the case. These stories come because people look around and they go, I don't know what the hell I just experienced. What happened? And then people and cultures and whatnot build belief systems around the experience that they've had.
Yeah, and to go with what you're saying, I mean, you can't just, how do you really, I mean, you can, but how do you just create a story out of nowhere? You have to, I always say the truth, you know, it comes from somewhere. It comes from something, whether how much of it is all true or not, it still comes from something.
I completely agree with you. You're absolutely right. It does. And I think it almost gaslights the people that have had the experience when you automatically write it off and say, okay, well, you've just, you know, you've heard this story, so therefore, and, mm-hmm. you know, and that's not good either.
I agree. And I think it was Chad Lewis on your episode was saying that you guys don't even know what the first documented story was. How old this legend or folklore actually is.
It's so old and it's so pervasive, you can't really trace it back. But that's the nature of thought, you know, that's the nature of thought. How far back does thought go? We have no idea. There was thought and then there was the universe. So we don't even know how far back it goes. So, you know, you can't really trace something like this because, you know, it really is the manifestation of trauma and of not only of isolation and of course starvation, because you can see it in the imagery of the Wendigo itself, but you know, you've got something that was birthed through trauma that started a very, very, very long time ago. And it may have not started out as the Wendigo. It may have started out very differently. And then as people began to experience something, it was added to and then slowly became the Wendigo. But it's very, very unique. And these thought forms, you know, it's definitely not alone in that category. These various thought forms that seem to, you know, exist in the world, they very rarely have an origin that you can pin down.
Yeah, it'd be pretty neat if you could, but like you said, you can't do that with thought.
Well, yeah, and it's a really great example of this, which I thought was very unique, was when Mike and I on the show, we were talking about the Jersey Devil and the idea that this weird looking pastiche of a creature, because it's literally every possible creature imaginable, you know, and people automatically, there's like the stigma about the Jersey Devil where people are like, oh, it's a weird looking thing, it can't exist, it's just bizarre. But at the end of the day, you know, the idea of the Jersey Devil and the Pine Barrens and whatnot, the area translates into the phrase the place of the dragon. And the place of the dragon, this creature, you know, that title was given a long time before the Jersey Devil ever happened. And somebody saw something or created something or whatever that was, you know, a something that the best word that they could find to describe it was dragon. That's not a situation where people are looking around going, you know, oh, I just, you know, I think I saw a dragon. No, that was the closest word that was available to describe what it was. And that should tell us something too. People think that, you know, when everybody has a paranormal experience, we all immediately go to, oh, this was a, you know, this had to be paranormal. But in reality, when you interview witnesses, the people try to figure out what it was. They usually don't go straight to, oh, this was a dragon or this was a gargoyle. They don't, you know, they start to try to work it out first.
You went logically first.
Absolutely. And so when you finally get down to the story and they look and they go, look, the best thing that I can compare this to was a dragon, or it was a really thin, tall, gray, patchy for Wendigo. Like, it's the closest thing that they can find to describe it. So you have to pay attention to that, I think, and not discount what people are seeing.
Yeah, and who knows if someone had seen that and then someone down the line made up that story of the woman who was her 13th child and cursed it, right, flew up the chimney.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing with Wendigo and these other bizarre thought form type creatures, is that, you know, the story often comes afterwards. It gets attached to the lore that is being created. And there was, of course, the sort of Rosemary's Baby story that came with the Jersey Devil, but there was also a second one that is less talked about, that had to do with a fellow by the name of Daniel Leeds, same clan. And it was a battle over a publishing issue that he had. And in the press, the Quakers, who were disagreed with what the guy was publishing, because he was very much into the occult and the paranormal and esoterics and stuff like that. And they came out and said, this man is the devil. Let this man be the devil. So there's been a couple of different stories attached to this idea of the Jersey Devil. But I mean, none of those may have anything to do whatsoever with the creature that people are seeing wandering around the Pine Barrens.
You know? Yeah.
May have nothing to do with it at all, and likely doesn't.
It might not. Have you ever been down there at all?
I haven't. And one of my goals this year is to be a little bit more present in the US, because it's one of my favorite countries in the world, and the places are just amazing. And I'm hoping to be able to come down and do some shows and experience some of these locations, because they've definitely captured my imagination, that's for sure.
Yeah, if you come down, let me know. I'm down for that. I've been wanting to go to Pine Barren for a while now. I have a whole list of places that I need to get to.
Two of us.
What's it, the Hockomock Swamp? Mm-hmm. What is that triangle called? It's not the Bennington Triangle, is it?
It rings, my brain's gone blank on
every time I forget. I can't, it's not Bennington Triangle. I think that's up in like Vermont or New Hampshire. Bridgewater Triangle, that's what it is.
There we go.
That's a place I really want to visit. That's so interesting. There's, I don't know. Do you know any of the history on that before
A
I
little
go
bit, yeah.
off?
A little bit, yeah, but tell the audience so that they know.
So I don't, I mean, I don't, I'm, I don't know much about it, but I believe it was back in, was it 16, 1700s? Native Americans cursed the land, and now there's so much stuff that can be seen there, from big dog man, massive anacondas, the ABCs, alien black cats. There's said to be like a staircase in the woods, or is it, I think I've heard that there's like just random fireplaces in the woods, and it's so thick in there that it wouldn't have been part of an old house or something like that. There's also phantom fires are seen, people phantom just like lanterns. You don't see the figure, but a
Yeah.
lantern being carried. So much going on there.
With a lot of these places and hold so much magic. And we often think that these places are in these faraway lands. But the one thing I've learned, even about Alberta, because Alberta, Canada is mostly, it's a lot of prairie. We've got beautiful woods. Like we've got a ton of green space. We've got very, very deep woods and mountains and Rockies and all sorts of things like that. We've got every terrain you can think of. But the one thing about it, even though it's very populated, is that it really doesn't take much to go off the beaten path. And when you start to dig into the underbelly of the history here, because it can be hard to get to. A lot of it's not spoken of or talked about, or it's buried pretty deep. But once you start to get into it, you realize that there is a plethora of fascinating, fascinating creatures, stories, tales, things like that, like things hidden in the woods that shouldn't be there. And we're taught all our lives shouldn't be there. And everybody always says, oh, people have an innate fear of the woods because, we're afraid of predators and so on and so forth. But there is something about the wild of these locations that really does hold secrets.
And you mentioned fear, which made me think of your ancestral DNA holding on to memories here. Maybe we don't remember what they are, but it's our DNA causing us to have these fear reactions from the woods, because who knows what our ancestors maybe experienced in the woods.
I think you bring up a really great point, and I agree. There was a debate kind of going on for a little while where people were saying, why is the uncanny valley the uncanny valley? Why are we afraid of things that kind of look like people? And one of the theories that was thrown into the mix was the idea that there were at one point things that looked like people that we needed to be afraid of. And I wonder with exactly with what you're saying is that there's something about these things that we innately know are in there, and that we know, that's not a good idea. We shouldn't do that. I've got a second book that's going to be coming out later this year called The Gift of Instinct. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to hammer down into in that book, was the idea that our connection to our inner selves and our connection to that which is greater than us is so important. And it has information that it will impart to you if you're willing to listen and not shuck it off. And I think this is such a great example of that.
As time goes on, it seems like we get farther and farther away from just being able to connect with, I don't know, with ourselves, with nature, everything like that. I mean, could you imagine if we could go back and kind of just remove all this buildup, like electronical that's on us, that's just blocking us from how we could be in touch with all these things? That kind of, it just, you tune out.
You do, and I think we can individually get back to that. But again, it comes back to that idea of making a conscious decision and making different choices about how we're tuning in to the information that's being dealt to us. I think some of our gizmos and gadgets are really important and are will aid, I think, in that instinct if we use it correctly. But I think the problem becomes when we're sitting there and we are reliant on the information that is coming into us rather than taking a step back and assessing said information with some of that internal guidance. And people miss that peace. They're just completely in reaction to what's going on in the environment, the information that they're getting fed. And you've got, you know, there's a lack of being able to step back and say, okay, hang on a minute. You know, what is my inner being telling me about this? How does this feel? Does this feel like truth? Does this feel like, is, you know, something's off with this? You know, what is it? Because I swear to God, we are the only bloody animal that will walk into, say, a parking lot, like an empty parking lot, and we know something's wrong, and we will walk right through that damn parking lot and still get mugged. You know, and it's like, we are the only one. We are like, if you put a gazelle in that same situation, they'd be gone. Like, gone.
You are 100% right. We could definitely learn some things.
Oh man, like we just, that angle, like even that side of things. And the great thing about stuff like that, and understanding that level of intuition and that understanding that level of interconnection, what people don't realize is that when you are living from that place and you are living from that space of that interconnection, then people innately know that you're living from that space, and they will go with you. The right people will go with you, because if you look at, say, for example, a herd of gazelle, you know, if that one gazelle gets an inkling that there is a lion that's in the grass, and that gazelle gets that inkling and moves on instinct and just takes off through the grass, the other gazelles do not stop to go, oh, I wonder where the hell he's going. They don't mm-hmm. stop to think that. They immediately know that you know, their teammate basically is moving on instinct, and they trust that instinct, and they take off, and they will, you know, the whole herd moves together. And it really does play a role when it comes to, as I say, things like paranormal and things like that, because, you know, when we are in the woods and we, you know, are experiencing these bizarre things, whether it be the Wendigo, whether it be Sasquatch, or whether it be, you know, whatever, we are being fed that information. It's in the environment, it's in our energy, and it's so important to really tap into that.
And even to go into more of the animal aspect, just look at our dogs. They're so in tune with everything, and you just pay attention to them, you can learn so much. You have people come to your house and your dog, you know, I've had dogs my whole life, and we've had multiple dogs through my family's whole life. And there's been certain people, the same person, that will come over and the dog doesn't like them. And then when time comes, you know, the dog passes away, you get a new dog, the new dog doesn't like that person either. And so on with, and you were saying to go into the woods. I got a text message from my friend the other day who has had some weird experiences in the woods with his brother. And they had heard samurai chatter, some weird things where the brother had heard his name being called in the woods. And he took his dog, he was going to a spot in the woods, and had his dog on the leash and was walking the dog, and the dog started sniffing in the air and just stopped and just was yanking him away and was like, nope, I'm done, let's go. So he listened to his dog. He was like, all right, we're gonna go.
Yeah, they know. And they know, because they are perceiving the world, first of all, we're perceiving the world from multiple different facets and senses that, I mean, we can't even wrap our heads around. But at the same time, they are also perceiving it from a level of connection that we tend to negate or miss. So I think, you know, when you see these animals and they're reacting in a certain way, like, not only are they reacting because they're experiencing on a sensory level something that is completely unique and different from us, but they also don't have that bias, and they don't have the stories in our heads that, you know, oh, if I bark at this guy, he's going to be offended and I don't want to hurt his feelings. They don't have that. They're just reacting on what they know and what their inner being is telling them. And, you know, of course you get the animals that are, you know, tainted enough by people that they're reacting out of anxiety or something like that. But there's something innately in touch with, I think, the greater part of who they are. And that's what makes animals so special. And I think that's why we're so drawn to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So, little segue here. Speaking of dogs, do you want to jump into Dog Man?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so before we even get into anything, what do you think Dog Man is? And even if you say you have no idea, that's fine too.
You know, it's taken me a while to really put pieces together with these things, because I live about 45 minutes from one, and here in Alberta, and it's a property that I've been investigating now for, oh brother, it's been quite a number of years. It's kind of been an ongoing project. Some friends of mine that they own this property, and they started out as my clients, and now they've become very good friends, because her husband had gone out to work the one morning, and they live on an acreage. They've got deep woods kind of out and around the acreage, and then their home is in the middle, and it's prairie everywhere else. It is just, it's complete flat prairie, which is typical dogman terrain. And I remember them calling me because her husband had gone out to work in the morning. It was still dark, and there was a spotlight kind of over his truck on the driveway. And he came back in, and he was white as a sheet, and very much a skeptic, this guy. And, you know, she had asked him, like, what's going on? And he said, I can't go to work today. And she said, why not? And he said, because there's a werewolf in the back of my truck. And she's the type of person, because she's like me, where, I mean, the first thing she does is put her coat on and go outside. So she goes outside, and it had taken off. It had left. But it was the beginning of a series of encounters with this thing, where they would see it climb up on the shop roof. The shop was right beside the truck in the house. It would climb up on the shop roof, and then it would climb up on the house. So it was going from the truck to the shop to the house. And it would sit up there, I'm assuming because it was a better view. And so her daughter saw it, as well as her son-in-law. And it would climb up on the roof. And it was I had an encounter where I don't want to say I saw it, but I sure as hell knew it was there, enough so that myself and a fellow investigator, when we went to the car, we walked backwards to the car because we didn't want to turn our backs in the woods. It was very definitive that we were being watched by a predator. But this property has been very, very fascinating to me. And so after all of this, and doing a fair amount of research, I'm really convinced that these dogmen are thought forms, and very, very similar to something like the Wendigo, where it seems to be mimicking live animal behavior. People see it picking up food and things like that, but it sure as heck doesn't fit any sort of evolutionary pattern that could have been possible. And there's things that it's doing or has done that it really doesn't fit with something that's a physical being. So, you know, my inclination is that these are probably a thought form that, again, started centuries back.
Oh, really? My thought is that there's some kind of interdimensional being. And I like that you said they kind of mimic and pick up the animal things. That's something I've never thought of. I always would think, you know, if someone's like, oh, well, if they're flesh and blood, then they don't need to eat. But I'm kind of the thought that, well, they could be interdimensional, and they could eat if they want, or they don't have to eat. But just because they eat doesn't mean that they aren't a paranormal animal. But I never thought of them just eating as trying to mimic and make people believe that they're some type of animal. I really like that thought.
Yeah, it was sort of an aha moment that I had when I was talking to Ken Gerhard. We were going back and forth on the show and throwing this idea around. And the aha moment for me during that episode was that oftentimes with negative entities, these inhuman thought forms that often cause lots of big problems in haunted homes and stuff like that, oftentimes what they do is they will mimic voices. It will try to mimic animals. You know, I've had cases where it will try to mimic, if the household has multiple dogs, it'll try to be the fourth out of the three dogs. And it'll mimic different behaviors to look like it should fit in the space. And it never quite works. There's always something wrong with the form. It just never quite seems to make it. And, you know, we assume, like, say, for example, the Beast of Bray Road, that one of the most famous stories was Laurie Andreese's story, where she was driving down the road in the middle of the night, and she saw it sitting by the side of the road with roadkill. And she said it was eating the roadkill. Well, how do we know that it was eating? We don't. It looks like it was eating. But when you look at these entities as a whole, there's really no definitive proof, I don't think, that this thing has been eating. Otherwise, we would have some DNA. So there's just holes in it with them that just don't make sense for it to be physical.
That's a good point. I'm not arguing your point, but I mean, also, too, how do we know that people, if you see a dog man and it's eaten a deer, I don't think many people are going to go back and grab that deer and test it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah, and that is innately is a problem because here's where the ambiguity starts, you know, where we don't have that proof, we don't have that evidence. A fellow by the name of Lee Hample, who lives on Bray Road, he's been putting out deer and carrion and stuff like that, and has had this thing basically living on his property for quite a while. And there was reports early on, I think it was back in the 80s, where the Vista Bray Road was getting into people's backyards and was taking pets, like it was being predatory with pets. And there was a couple of ladies who walked out into the backyard and saw it standing there with its cat, their cat in its mouth, and it got spooked and it dropped the cat. And the cat was okay. They took the cat to the vet and whatever. But there again, it's like, okay, that would have been a really, really great chance to pull some DNA from something like this, but it never seems to come to that. But I think my point with these things seemingly interacting with the environment is that we get lots of cases of these entities interacting with the environment through psychokinesis as well. There's lots of cases that we've taken on in hauntings and things like that, where they do pick up animals, they do pick up people. They are physically moving things around the space. They have mass, they're triggering cameras and stuff like that. But you know, with the Beast of Bray Road, which is a prime example, and even with the property that I've been dealing with in Alberta, we've got trail cams all over the property, and these things fire like no tomorrow, and there's nothing in the damn photo. So you've got this really strange, almost camouflage thing that's going on with these. I don't pretend to understand at all.
Are you getting any sort of mists or anything like that on the trail cams at all?
I know on Bray Road, I know Lee Hample has been getting those where they will put food down and they will catch the mist in the trail cam, and then when the mist disappears, the food's gone. We haven't noticed mist so far, but there's been times where you know the trail cams, they will trigger, you know, 200 to 300 times a day, and they will fire back literally nothing. And then you'll have an animal walk by and trigger the trail cam like normal, like a moose or a skunk or something like that, where and there's nothing seemingly triggering this in the picture at all. I mean, the damn thing shouldn't have fired. So I mean, we've been up and down trying to figure out what this is, but I don't know.
Do you think there's something related to that with the Glimmer Man?
It's an interesting thought, and you know, and again, it sort of falls into that sort of same category. You know, I think we have to look with any of these things. I think we have to look back in the history of what other cultures are telling us about these things. Like in for example, within the First Nations here in Alberta, and I know in some areas of Wisconsin and things like that too, they typically associate these with protection. They are assigned to a space almost to look after and look out and protect the space. Oftentimes we've
Yeah,
seen around burial grounds, right?
I've heard that.
And there's burial grounds on the Alberta property here as well. So
Oh, that makes it 10 times more interesting.
doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think we have to kind of like look back on where these things have stemmed from culturally, and when you can kind of go back far enough. You know, I mean, there was dog-headed creatures reported in for Egypt, for example, you know, way back. So I think the further back you go, sort of the more you can start to discern where in this did it start? You know, where did the focus begin on these? Was it people that were experiencing them, or were there legends and then this thing started to form? So I think whether you're talking about Dog Man or like things like the Glimmer Man or anything like that, it's kind of all falls into that same.
With Bigfoot, they have this fur. And I think other people have had this theory that their fur is translucent, and it's kind of how there's, you know, like a chameleon or octopus can just blend in with its surroundings, something along those lines.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I
But that
know
would
that.
make sense why your cameras are tripping, but nothing's coming. I think they have that intelligence to say, hey, there's a camera here, but I'm gonna
Yeah,
block myself.
I had a theory for a little while about that with apparitions is, and my idea behind it was that we're not actually, the apparition isn't actually disappearing. It's just hitting light in a way in which we can't see it. Because oftentimes these, you'll hear examples of these apparitions being sighted and whatnot, and they say, oh, it turned around and it was gone. Or, you know, I stepped to the side and it disappeared. Or I went to look at it and it vanished. And, you know, it vanished to our eyes. We don't know if the mass itself actually vanished. We just stopped being able to perceive it. So I had a running theory for a while, and it's still kind of there in the back of my mind, that this is more of a perceptual issue with the living than it is an issue with the entity, for example, just turning around and disappearing.
I really like the way you think, because I hadn't thought of that before, but that's really, really good.
Well, I mean, I've had so many experiences like that, that, you know, you start to sort of hash it over, think, you know, well, what if this isn't about them? And it's so easy, I think, with the paranormal, we like to make it about us versus whatever it is out there.
Yeah.
And it isn't, you know, it's our perception is so limited. And we forget that everything in our environment, everything that we're perceiving, is light-based. When you can get your head around the fact that it's light and particle-based, and, you know, when those light particles shift and our eyes struggle with it, then things start to either, you know, get murky or get muddy or disappear, or, you know, our perception is that they vanish. But it doesn't necessarily, just because we're seeing it that way, doesn't mean that that's what's happening.
I think the more people get into this stuff, the more we will learn about it, different takes on things.
Oh, absolutely. And that's really is the whole key, is discussions like this that break down and throw ideas around as to what it is might actually be going on. This is the work.
Yeah, because I think there might have been, like, maybe one thing that I said that you hadn't, it seemed like you hadn't thought of before. And then you said a couple things that I had never thought of before. And then we talk about it, and then you go back and tell somebody else what I said, and I'll go back and tell somebody else. And we throw these ideas, and the more people that think about it, the more ideas we come up with. And maybe I don't think we'll ever solve this, but it's just fascinating to keep going with it.
Oh, it is. And that, it really is the joy in the journey with the paranormal. And, you know, the people that think that this is, you know, all one day is all going to be solved. Our brains don't have the damn capacity to solve some of this stuff. Like, I mean, it is so much bigger than us. And we get these little glimpses into how the universe works and whatnot. But I mean, even the brightest minds in the world are still looking around going, well, we don't know. And, you know, as soon as we can, you know, put the egos aside and say, you know what, we don't know, and that's okay, then all of a sudden, you know, worlds open up, and then, you know, people start to have good conversations instead of, you know, trying to, you know, use sort of a materialistic based evidence system, which is, you know, falling by the wayside now.
I think there's more to be learned from saying I don't know than just having it set in your mind that something is what it is.
Oh, it's the perfect position that you want to be in. And I often tell that to clients too, where they say, oh my God, I don't know what I'm going to do because I've lost my job, or, you know, this has changed, or I don't have this anymore, and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, it really is your blank canvas. And it wraps right back to how we started this conversation, which is, what story are you going to tell about blank canvas?
I was just going to bring that back, and you did it for me. So there you go.
Yeah, it comes right back to that. It's just when you realize that I don't know, and embracing the unknown is really a chance for something better and a chance for more information and more knowledge. Oftentimes we are put in a place of repositioning and transition by the universe, because the universe, and it doesn't care when it does it. That's the crappy part, is that it really doesn't care. It just is like, okay, this is now going to be a reposition. And it could be through a traumatic experience. It could be through a positive experience. But when we get repositioned and we are in that position where we are transitioning into that new area of our life and our knowledge or whatever, then that is the time where we can turn around and go, okay, I don't know. Let's decide what's next. What is next? What do you want to be next?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Before I forget these questions, when you were, no, that wasn't the same property, was it, that you you said you didn't see a dog man, but you thought that you did have an experience and that you felt like there was something watching you in the woods. Yes. What was your sensory that you were having with that?
It was very interesting, actually, because when the investigator and I, when we left the house, it was dark, and prairie dark, there's nothing like prairie dark, is black. And so the only light that we had was the lights that were illuminating the house and that were kind of being beamed onto the driveway. And we walked out the door and we kind of walked towards the woods a little bit because we were chatting and whatnot. And we got the distinct impression that we were being watched in the same way that if you sensed that there was a cougar in the bush, that's what it felt like, that there was a physical presence in the bush that was watching.
Very primal,
very animalistic, to the point where if somebody had said, yeah, there's a pack of wolves in the area, you would have been like, the wolves are out. But there isn't. And we stopped and we could see something standing in the tree line. And it was quite tall and it was quite thin. And it didn't move much. It was still, but we knew it was there. And the two of us, we kind of just looked at each other and we didn't want to take our eyes off of it for very long, because it felt like if we had have turned around at that moment, it would have been out of those bushes in 2 seconds. But so what we did was we just slowly backed up to the car. We behaved in the same way we would if we had been faced with a bear or something like that. We just slowly backed up and just gave it its distance and respect. We got in the car, and as we were driving down the driveway, the feeling started to dissipate because they've got quite a long driveway out to one of the main dirt roads. And what was interesting was about 2 minutes after we left, I got a text message from the owner of the house, and they have two dogs, one great big lazy old mountain dog that sits on their porch all the time. Real sweet old thing. And so like this dog, a porcupine at one point moved into his doghouse and he didn't even bark.
Oh, like, I remember that when I had first talked to you, you talked about that.
This dog, so I mean, cute. You couldn't bother this dog if you poked it with a stick. And he was outside, and she said, by any chance, did you guys see anything when you were leaving the house? And we said, yeah, actually we did. We were pretty sure that we were getting watched and, you know, escorted off the property. And she said, because she's like, my dog is outside right now and he's losing his mind. He's barking his brains out at something in the woods. And so we said, okay. Yeah. We said, we're pretty sure it was your giant puppers out there that was watching us and making sure that not being threatening, but I think, you know, making sure that we were leaving.
Given the description of these dog men, and I mean, I don't know of stories where they have killed people. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there are stories like that. They could come after you and they could probably just kill you in one swoop. And I've heard it so many times that they just want to scare the hell out of you, and that the fear is their energy.
Yeah, I think as far as I know, and from as far as what I've read, I've never heard of somebody being physically attacked by one of these things, which I think is very significant, because you know, you've got something that is seemingly predatory, but it doesn't look like, you know, humans are really on its menu per se. And the cases throughout the states and throughout Canada have usually consisted of the same thing, which is they are, you know, that they're sighted by either one of these burial mounds or cemeteries or whatever, and they growl at whoever it is, and then they book it after them, and they take off, and the person's running like mad, and lo and behold, after a short amount of time, it breaks the chase off. So there's something that's going on that either it's, you know, it's trying to protect something. It wants them off its property. And interestingly, again, with a lot of negative entities, very, very territorial. These thought forms tend to be highly aggressive, very territorial, and oftentimes that's what people run into when they're dealing with negative entities and hauntings, is it's a territory dispute. And with these guys, it seems to be very, very similar, but it's overlaid with this protecting these burials or this burial mound. What was fascinating with the Alberta case for us was that the dogman there was cited before we knew that there were bodies on the property. And when they came forward and said, we just saw a werewolf in the back of the truck, oddly enough, that was one of the things that I thought of right away, because I said, I wonder if there's somebody's buried on your land. And it was about, oh gosh, it was a number of months later, because we had to wait for winter to go away. But we brought in a team of cadaver dogs, and lo and behold, we had confirmation of hits on this property that there were
really
no remains. But the dog man was the indicator.
There's something to it that makes me think that they're not allowed to attack us, because they seem so miserable that you would think that they want to tear our faces off. But it just, maybe there's some kind of rule that they can't. I don't know what to think about them.
I'm not sure either. I mean, they seem to be highly motivated for one job, which is to make sure that their property is looked after. And that seems to be their lot in life is that, you know, you look at cases even like Skinwalker Ranch in Utah, and you know, the Unitah Basin there, and
that's another place on my list.
It's totally, and you know, and there we have reports of these dogmen. They're walking along the ridge of the basin, back and forth, and so, you know, and we've got a situation there where again you've had burial grounds and whatever that were identified, because there was a large scale war between the Navajo and the Ute back in the day. And so you've got another situation where they're there and they seem to just be, you know, patrolling the land, and you don't get in their way because they'll, you know, they'll chase you down. But I know the one here in Alberta that we've been dealing with, I mean, he's not a concern when we're out there. We're never feeling like, you know, okay, you better have a gun or something like that. You know, this thing, you're going to have to fend it off. It's never approached anyone. And both their son-in-law and their daughter have gotten quite close to it. And there was never an attack or a, you know, or any sort of a, you know, attempts to bite or anything like that. So I don't know, like we don't seem to be an issue other than we sometimes get too close.
I don't know what to say after that. I had stuff I was thinking about, and then you're talking about them getting close to it, that I just, that's scary.
I'm hoping that I really would love to see, I'd love to see him. I still have yet to see him other than that one incident when it was, I'm pretty sure it was in the woods there. But yeah, it's funny because he's become very familiar. The couple that own this property, he's really become sort of a part of the property and a part of the daily life, I guess. And yeah, he's become a bit of a staple, I think. In our world, like I think if he disappeared all of a sudden, I think everybody would kind of miss him. He's so unique and so different, and I don't know, I highly respect whatever it is. And
so they're cool. Not thrown by it.
No, and I mean, granted, I mean, these two that I work with, I mean, they've been around the block with paranormal stuff, so they're pretty hardened.
Yeah, pretty frightened. Seasoned.
And I think. So, I mean, they come at it from, I think, a very different perspective. They're First Nations as well. And
okay.
I think, so they come at it from a very unique perspective too. And, but man, they, yeah, it's, I don't know. I would miss him if all of a sudden he disappeared.
Gosh. And do you think there's more than one there? You think it's just the one guy the one dog man that's there?
Oh, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's highly possible that there is more than one, and all we've seen is the one, or we've been seeing multiple and we just have no idea. But it seems like everything that we've noticed about them has been that he seems to be singular. But again, even in, when you look at, you know, predatory behavior in animals like wolves and stuff like that, oftentimes you only ever see one. You've got a pack of wolves or something like that, you'll have the one wolf that will corner the prey and direct it towards the pack, and you don't see the rest of the pack until you're a little bit too late. So, I mean, it's always possible that you've got something that is completely pack driven and is, and that's how it's operating. But it seems that most encounters are with one individual.
Have they ever gotten any kind of telepathic communication from this guy?
Not this one, but that has been reported in other cases.
Yeah, where, yeah, that's why I figured I'd ask.
Yeah, and nothing with this guy. And I think because he doesn't make his presence known very long. It typically is rather a short incident. He gets seen and he's gone very quickly after that. I don't think he's looking for human interaction.
When you first started talking about this, I had chills. I was terrified, and now I'm kind of like, oh, maybe I want to go up there. And I mean, regardless, I'd want to go see what's up. But it doesn't seem so frightening. I think that's the first time I've ever heard something like that.
Yeah, I think, I think they're all different. Like, I mean, a beast of Bray Road's been known to climb on cars and chase cars down, and you know, I mean, he's pretty active. And same with Michigan Dogman. People have had encounters with Michigan Dogman where they've said straight up, if I had stepped 2 feet forward, this thing would have come at me. So they might have different personality types too, just in the same way that
people do.
You know, people do, or entities for that matter.
Does it still walk on their roof, or was that kind of when they first just moved in, or first started living there?
It was very recently, actually. That
oh, really?
She had been in her garage just a few weeks ago, and had come home, and she heard it walking on the roof over top of her.
And holy hell!
Yeah, and she said you could hear the crunching of paws on the roof, and she went out to see him. And interestingly enough, she couldn't see him; she could hear him.
Wow.
Yeah, you could hear the paws. You could hear these great big feet, because you can't miss him. He's huge, 8 feet tall. But she went out and she couldn't see him, but twice she heard him walking along up on the roof. And she's pretty sure that he's looking for a vantage point. It's easier to see the rest of the woods.
Oh, I didn't think of it like that. See, this is why I like talking to you, because you come at it from a different angle. I hate the stories of the things walking on the roof, no matter what it is that they are.
It's really creepy.
It just really bothers me, because it feels like it's such a, like a dominance type, like, I got you now, you can't leave your house, because no matter what you do, this thing is literally above you.
Yeah, and I think with this guy, I don't think it's an intentional scare. I think with this guy, he's looking for a better vantage point. I know the one time they said they saw him peeking in the bedroom window. He was up there, and they were coming back in back up to the property, and they see him like curious about the bedroom window. But it wasn't, I don't think, done out of aggression or purposeful intimidation. It seemed like he was just up there and just interested in what was going on in the house. But yeah, he I definitely don't feel threatened by him in any way. I wouldn't want to get in a battle with him. I mean, I don't think he'd win, you know.
No. Definitely not. I could just go on and on all night about this subject, but I think I've kept you long enough. So I appreciate so much you coming back and joining me again. And my dogs are barking again through the whole thing, talking about Dogman again.
They know.
Yeah, they know. We've been on here for a little over an hour now, and it's just been, it went so fast. It's been so great, because like I said, talking to different people, talking to you, and you get different ideas and different thoughts and different ways of looking at it. And I definitely walked away from this conversation with different ways of looking at multiple different things. So thank you for that. Oh, it's very cool.
I'm so glad. And it's my pleasure. And every time I have a conversation like this, I feel the same way, because, I learn every time that we people like this, we sit down, we get together and we talk about it, because there's always something that comes out of it that makes you view things in a new light. And so I appreciate you having me on very much.
Yeah. Yeah. And please again, tell everybody where we can find your new book and your website, your YouTube channel, all of your stuff. Oh, and your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So people can find me at entityseeker.ca. And that's what's the main website, as well as supernaturalcircumstances.com, which is my podcast with the incredible Mr. Mike Brown from the Dark Poutine podcast. And people can pick up my new book, well, pretty much anywhere, Amazon included. And it's called Teaching the Living: From Heartbreak to Happiness in a Haunted Home. And it's the second edition. It's, as I say, it's packed full of brand new stuff and new information and some pretty cool insights, I think. So I'm hoping that people will grab onto that, you know, go out and buy it. Shameless self-promotion.
Hey, that's okay. Absolutely. I know I'm going to order that. I have this like stack of all these paranormal books that I have to read. It's like I finally get into bed at like 9 o'clock at night and I'm like too tired to read and I'll do it later. And I don't get to it. And I need to make that a point. Away. No, it just gets bigger.
Yeah, it's like laundry. It just never goes away.
Oh, laundry. That's the worst. But thank you so much, Morgan. I'm going to let you go. And I enjoyed this so much. Thank you again.
Thanks, Laura.
Alrighty. I will talk to you later.
An unfamiliar voice spoke from the other side of the door.
Let me in.
Her hand reflexively grasped the knob, unable to control her own movements. The door opened. A monstrous being stood before her. She gagged at its stench and fell to her knees. It stood in the doorway. A black substance dripped from its body and puddled at its feet. It looked down at her and said,
"That's a good girl. Now aren't you going to invite me in?"
She shook her head back and forth as tears streamed from her eyes. It smiled a depraved grin, revealing black, rotted teeth. It said,
"Still following Daddy's advice about strangers? Well, he's in hell. He burns over and over and over again."
We Only Come Out at Night, the brand new book from Nomar Slevic. 33 horror fiction stories that will remind you that what lies beyond the darkness only comes out at night. We Only Come Out at Night is available only in print and can be found at slevicstore.company.site or at the Green Hand Bookshop at greenhandbookshop.com.